Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program. This one is being recorded for the listening week that begins May 4th. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This week, you'll be hearing a wide array of topics from a variety of sources. Beginning with news from the music world. This first one appeared in a recent edition of the Boulder Daily Camera. It is written by Olivia Doak. He was a son of the state. Oh, pardon me, that is, he's a son of the state. Materials from banjo artist Otis Taylor, now housed at CU Boulder. Materials from Otis Taylor's decades-long career as an internationally recognized Boulder-based blues banjo artist are now part of an archived collection at the University of Colorado Boulder. Taylor, who's lived in Boulder since 1967, has released 15 albums and been at the forefront of black banjo music. Taylor won many awards throughout his career for his music, which was often about race, injustice, and the hardships black people face. Taylor was inducted into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame in 2019. Quote, "He's a very wonderful addition on many levels. First of all, Otis is a great artist that is well-renowned, but whose work has not received enough recognition," end quote. Austin Ogigbo, interim director of the American Music Research Center at CU Boulder, said. He goes on, quote, "I think housing his work at the AMRC is the best way to give him the visibility, the recognition, and the honor that he deserves as someone who has made major contributions to American music and culture," end quote. Materials from Taylor's career are now part of CU Boulder's American Music Research Center archival collections housed in the university library's Rare and Distinctive Collections. The American Music Research Center supports the research, performance, and preservation of all music, of all music of the Americas, with a particular emphasis on music diversity from the United States. The center holds a rare collection of scores, papers, recordings, and other material artifacts that document the history of American music, that now includes Taylor's collection. Megan Friedel, head of collections management and stewardship for Rare and Distinctive Collections, estimates there are about 100 boxes of material covering his entire career. Those boxes include recordings of his work, handwritten lyrics for original songs, concert posters and programs, concert t-shirts, photographs, news articles, and documentation of awards he's won. The plan is to finish organizing this material by the end of the summer, so they'll be available for use in the fall. Quote, "You don't have to be affiliated with CU to use the collection. You don't have to be a scholar," end quote, said Friedel. She went on, "Anyone can make an appointment in the Rare and Distinctive Collections reading room, beginning in the fall, to see the collection. There will be a guide to the collection online, so they can select the boxes and folders they want to look at," end quote. Taylor said he's glad people will be able to study his materials and learn about the real history of the blues, Colorado, and American music. He said the archive is the right place for him and his music and will create a lasting legacy. Taylor said, quote, "It's a big honor being recognized. I'm very honored. I think it's the right place for me and solves the problem of what happens to me when I'm gone," end quote. Friedel said she hopes the collection will be used in classes so students can learn from it, especially within the College of Music. Friedel said, quote, "It's one of several collections that we've received over the past 5 or 6 years that really starts to solidify Colorado's place in the national music scene," end quote. Anyone with questions about the collections can email rad@colorado.edu. That's rad@colorado.edu. Quote, Otis is somebody who is well-rooted in the state of Colorado, and therefore he's a son of the state whose contribution needs to be celebrated, end quote, Ogigbo said. Next, an article from the Wall Street Journal, April 13th, weekend edition. It's a review of a book titled Revolutions in American Music by Michael Broyles. The article is titled How the Country Got in Rhythm, and it's written by Preston Lauterbach. In Revolutions in American Music, the Florida State University musicology professor Michael Broyles argues that forces of race and technology combined to create new national sounds during three pivotal decades, the 1840s, the 1920s, and the 1950s. This approach encompasses an eclectic cast of characters and emphasizes a multicultural heritage. As Mr. Broyles explains, the origin of one truly American form of music emerged through our uniquely American history of race, minstrelsy, which had gained prominence by the 1840s, was the first major crossover of black street culture into white mainstream entertainment. Though it stereotyped and mocked black speech, dress, and dance, among other features, minstrelsy, we are told, likely had black originators. A New Orleans street vendor known as Old Cornmeal, and a street dancer there named Picayune Butler were known to, quote, jump Jim Crow, singing and dancing as the character whose name would become synonymous with racial segregation. But it was T.D. Rice, a white performer in blackface, who made Jim Crow famous on the American stage in what Mr. Broyles calls a, quote, monster hit that set off, quote, a revolution in American music, dash, the creation of the minstrel show. Minstrelsy, Mr. Broyles writes, quote, defined what white culture wanted to believe about black Americans, end quote. It also provided white Americans with, quote, a portrait of the American black, the reach of which far outlasted the institution of slavery, end quote. Even American music has an original sin, apparently. Nevertheless, minstrelsy had its moments of redemption when coupled with the technological development of sheet music publishing. One example of the genre humanized enslaved people. In 1844, the songwriter E.P. Christie published Lucy Neal, a tearjerker about an enslaved family being sold apart. The song was meant to broaden Christie's appeal, especially among the burgeoning middle class of the North, and the plan worked. Christie's Minstrels soon became one of the most popular singing groups in the country. The story of minstrelsy has often been told. It is Mr. Broyles' focus on a different revolution, a 19th century dance craze and its long influence, that truly surprises. The polka, he writes, quoting, provided the musical template for American dance music for the next 100 years. Its rhythm and vitality, not only the seed for many dances to come, but a symbol for an ebullient, ever-expanding America, end quote. Mr. Broyles attributes the spread of the polka to a roving instructor named Gabriel de Corpone, who worked the Northeast in the middle 1840s. A prominent political cartoonist of the day used the serendipitously named dance to mock presidential candidate James K. Polk, adding to the dance's currency. As for its legacy, Mr. Broyles explains, quote, the polka inaugurated a large cycle of fast two-step rhythms and movements, end quote. that ran through the 19th century and, quote, finally culminated in the dances of the 20s jazz age, end quote. And so Mr. Broyles polkas his way into the 20th century, when technology assumes a greater power in shaping sounds, the prevalence of the phonograph and radio in American homes, commercialized music to unprecedented degrees. One unintended consequence was the delivery of jazz into places it could not otherwise have reached. White groups, such as the original Dixieland Jazz Band, brought the genre into mainstream America thanks to a level of access to record companies and top-shelf dance halls that was denied to the music's African-American originators. This process of sneaking black culture to white audiences in white disguise, dash, a legacy of minstrelsy and a foreshadowing of rock and roll, was becoming the quintessential American music story. Meanwhile, ultramodernist music had begun to take shape as a break from the classical tradition of orchestral music. Ultramodernists challenged definitions of melody, rhythm, harmony, and tone. So shocking and different was the music that the composer Charles Ives once had to warn his copyist, quote, "Do not correct any of the wrong notes. The wrong notes are right," end quote. No one had heard anything like it, but on the connection between race and technology on the one hand, and the rise of ultramodernism, a movement of white male composers, Mr. Broyles remains silent. Among the book's most compelling passages is a discussion of yodeling, popularized by Jimmy Rogers in his Blue Yodel series of the late 1920s and early 30s. The vocal style draws on European tradition and became most strongly associated in America with cowboy singers like Gene Autry. But Mr. Broyles, whose analysis here surpasses Nick Tosches's in his book Where Dead Voices Gather, reveals a surprising backstory. Yodeling, he tells us, has African roots, predating the earliest known yodels in the Alps, and could have arrived in America by way of the first cargoes of enslaved people, long before Rogers became known as the singing brakeman. Black performers were gaining acclaim across the South with the technique, including Beulah Henderson, who by the late 19th century was known as, quote, "America's only colored lady yodeler." Mr. Broyles explores the black influences on Rogers' earliest recordings and suggests that the stunning syncopated guitarist Blind Blake exerted a powerful effect over the singing brakeman's version of In the Jailhouse Now. In the 1950s, the new mass medium of television broadcast the latest version of minstrelsy, rock and roll, to America. As T.D. Rice had brought the style of old cornmeal to a national crowd, white Americans who didn't know the blues shouter Big Joe Turner from the R&B Wild Man, Little Richard, beheld the gyrating midsection of Elvis Presley and the non-threatening nonsense of Pat Boone singing Tutti Frutti, a quintessential American tradition continued. Hip-hop history comes along later than the three decades Mr. Broyles analyzes, but it embodies the race technology revolution as well, if not better, than its predecessors. Most importantly, hip-hop has brought American music's racial dynamic nearly full circle. 19th century black performers and 20th century blues singers mostly made white businessmen rich. Today, some rap artists, such as Jay-Z, have jumped from the street to the boardroom. A look at hip-hop would have provided Mr. Broyles' discussion with a degree of relevance that his focus on polka, while fascinating, does not. This small portion of beef aside, Mr. Broyles serves a highly digestible history, showing in lively detail how eclectic inventiveness has defined American culture. And one more from the music world. from another forgotten legend. This is going to be about Eddie Durham, and it's written by Dan Baker. It says at the bottom, Dan Baker is a freelance editor, writer, and musician living in Brooklyn. And this comes via the Brooklyn Rail. Eddie Durham, forgotten guitar pioneer. I discovered Eddie Durham one night long ago, one night not long ago, as I tuned up my radio to the marvelously pedantic Phil Schaap on WKCR-FM. Phil was playing the legendary Kansas City 6, parentheses, and 5, sessions from 1938, 14 small combo cuts featuring Basie alumni, produced by John Hammond for Milt Gabler's unprofitable, idealistic Commodore label. Durham on electric guitar shone even in the stellar company of Lester Young and Buck Clayton. His playing had the kind of rare originality that makes you sit up and say, "Who the hell is this guy?" Which I've been investigating since that night. Here are the facts. Durham, of African-American / Native American heritage, was born in San Marcos, Texas in 1906. His father, who, quote, played the fiddle at square dances, taught him to both read and notate. By his early teens, Eddie was playing trombone and guitar professionally in the Durham Brothers Band with his brother and two cousins. By about 20, he was a member of, perhaps, the seminal Southwestern jazz band of the era, Walter Page's Blue Devils. Durham serves as guitarist / trombonist / arranger, not only for the Blue Devils, but also for their next incarnation, Benny Moten's Orchestra, and their next incarnation, the Count Basie Band. Given this pedigree and the fact that he worked with a constellation of artists that included Cab Calloway, Jimmy Lingford, Andy Kirk, Artie Shaw, Glenn Miller, Harry James, and Billie Holiday, Durham was among with Cy Oliver, probably one of the two most important arrangers in all of Southwestern swing. Among the well-known titles he either arranged or composed were Moten Swing, Topsy, Lunsford Special, Harlem Shout, Swingin' the Blues, Lafayette, Good Morning Blues, 1 o'clock Jump, Jumpin' at the Woodside, and In the Mood. Southwestern swing, based in Kansas City in the 30s, was usually riff-based and a good deal more bluesy than its East Coast counterpart. Gunther Schuller, author of the books Early Jazz and The Swing Era, contrasts Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins as quintessential exponents of the respective styles. He claims that whereas the East Coast-based Hawkins and his followers developed a vertical style of playing, following chord changes strictly, Young and his followers phrased horizontally with long, fluid, vocal-inflected phrases that overlapped changes, facilitating a more rolling, uninterrupted groove. This is an important point because Kansas City jazz carried forward the rhythmic / emotional content of the blues into the R&B era, roughly early 40s through mid-50s, and thus into rock and roll vocals. Fittingly enough, Durham pops up in L.A. in the early 50s, parentheses, where an astounding number of Southwestern jazz and blues artists wound up as band leader for Wynonna Harris, a disciple of Turner and the man credited with perhaps the first rock and roll song, Good Rockin' Tonight, from 1947. Durham, who is credited by some historians with actually inventing riff-based jazz, is thus a key figure in the evolution of 20th century music. But that's not all. Durham was also a major electric guitar innovator, both technically and artistically, if not actually the inventor of the electric guitar, parentheses, its provenance is still clouded. Durham can at least claim to be among a handful of true pioneers. He began to experiment with his acoustic guitar as early as 1929, enhancing its volume with an affixed piepan. Quote, "It was about the size of a breakfast plate. When you'd hit those strings, the piepan would ring and shoot out the sound. I'd also use a megaphone with it." End quote. Durham also played a National steel guitar with a resonator through a microphone at live shows. His historic solo on the Lunsford Band's Hittin' the Bottle from September 1935 was played with a pickup-equipped acoustic guitar through a low-watt amp. Leonard Feather identified it as, quote, "the first recorded example of any form of guitar amplification," end quote. Durham recalled, quote, "Dr. Armand came out with a pickup, which I got, but they didn't have any sound amplifiers, so I'd get any kind of amp I could find and sit it on the corner of the stage and run a cord to the guitar, and that was it. And if we were playing in a big auditorium, I'd go directly into the sound system. You couldn't play rhythm like that because it was too loud. I used to blow the lights in a lot of places. I'd just play solo work. And I think that at the time, I was the only guy playing that kind of guitar in jazz." End quote. It's fair to say that without Eddie Durham, there would be no Charlie Christian. According to Eddie himself, when he met banjo, the ukulele player, Floyd Smith, on the 1937 Basie tour, quote, "He wanted to play like me, but he didn't have a guitar, and his mama wouldn't buy him one. He came to me and asked me to say to his mother, 'Mrs. Smith, this boy could be a genius on the guitar if you'd just buy him one.' After I did that, he got his first guitar." End quote. 2 years later, when Smith was precluded from joining Benny Goodman's band by his contract with Andy Kirk, he recommended Christian in his place. Durham first encountered Christian on the same tour, quoting, "We met in an Oklahoma City pool hall. Charlie was only playing a little piano then. He wasn't playing guitar yet. He asked me to give him some pointers, like what to do if you want to play with class and get through life with the instrument. He wanted to know technical things, like how to pick a certain way. So I showed him how to sound like I did. I said, quote, 'Don't ever use an upstroke, which makes tag a tag a tag sound. Use a downstroke. It takes an awful fast wrist to play a downstroke. It gives a staccato sound with no legato, and you sound like a horn.'" End quote. Maddeningly, mainstream accounts of the era often ignore these contributions completely. Thus, NPR's music website, quoting, "In the late 1930s, guitar pioneers Floyd Smith and Charlie Christian brought the electric guitar into the jazz world and redefined the role of the guitar in the swing orchestra ensemble," end quote. Here is the key to Durham's guitar style. He was trying to duplicate the phrasing of a trombone, both by amplifying it, widening its tone and enhancing its sustain, and playing with uncharacteristic intervals and attack. In these respects, he is remarkably similar to another overlooked great from the same era, Bob Dunn, who played amplified steel guitar for Milton Brown. Both men, as if they were discovering the wonders of a brand new vocabulary at every moment, and in a sense they were, both played as if they were discovering the wonders of a brand new vocabulary at every moment, and in a sense they were. Guitar cliches were yet to be born, so there was nothing to get in their way. Listening to Durham and Dunn, and many others from the same era like Lonnie Johnson, Blind Blake, and Django Reinhardt, can restore one's faith in an instrument that has so often fallen into the wrong hands. Parentheses, axes of evil, axes. It's also a reminder that categories like jazz, country, rock, and R&B are best used with extreme caution. Next article comes from NPR, CPR News, and was posted April 25th, written by Scott Newman. He missed a chance to be the first black astronaut. Now, at 90, he's going into space. Edward J. Dwight Jr. has waited a long time for his ride into space. In the 1960s, he seemed poised to become America's first black astronaut. That dream was never realized. Now, at age 90, he's about to finally get his shot aboard a Blue Origin rocket. The opportunity, quote, is a curiosity more than anything else. They called me up and asked me if I was interested, and of course I said yes, says Dwight. While Dwight won't be, the first African-American in space, that honor went to Gion Bluford Jr. in 1983. He will be the oldest person to go there, edging out by a few months Star Trek actor William Shatner, who flew aboard a Blue Origin rocket in 2021. For many his age, a journey into space would seem unthinkable. Dwight says he's ready to go. He points out that the rigors of his upcoming flight won't be much different from what he's experienced as a test pilot in the Air Force. Quote, I've pulled more G's than any person on Earth, he says with a wry smile. I've been high enough to see the curvature of the Earth. I've been doing things like that most of my life, end quote. Space health expert Dorit Donaville says the 11-minute flight of Blue Origin's New Shepard rocket means many of the concerns about the long-term effects of orbital and deep space missions won't come into play. Donaville says, the main thing we worry about is the G-forces. He's director of the Translational Research Institute for Space Health at Baylor College of Medicine. Those G-forces cause blood to drain from the head, and that's an issue for anyone launching into space, regardless of age. However, she points out that the seats aboard Blue Origin's rocket are angled at 20 or 30 degrees. Donaville says, quote, as you're experiencing the G-forces, you're getting it through the chest, which is not affecting your head. It's distributed through the chest, which really shouldn't matter very much, end quote. And then there's the landing. The crew capsule will separate from the booster and come down under a set of parachutes, emitting a last-minute retrothrust to reduce speed to about 2 miles per hour to cushion the impact. Donaville says, quote, it's not even a controlled crash, it's a crash, end quote. Still, she anticipates no issues. No launch date set. Blue Origin has not announced a launch date yet, but Dwight and his crewmates will train for 2 days before liftoff at the company's launch site, 1, in western Texas, not far from the Mexico border. The company owned by billionaire Jeff Bezos declined to disclose the pre-passenger cost of the flight. Oh, pardon me, that's per-passenger cost of the flight, but says Dwight's seat is being sponsored by Space for Humanity and Blue Origin, with additional support from the Jason and Jamie Robinson Family Foundation. Parentheses, Jason Robinson, who flew on a previous Blue Origin flight, is on the NPR Foundation Board of Trustees. Leland Melvin, a retired NASA astronaut who flew 2 space shuttle missions to the International Space Station, says it will be good to see Dwight finally get his due all these years after he first trained for space. Dwight sees his upcoming space flight as, quote, the climax to an interesting story. His own story, that is. One of the earliest chapters begins at an airfield in Kansas City, Kansas. As a child, Dwight's fascination with aviation led to odd jobs, cleaning aircraft owned by wealthy flyers. But even then, he had great ambitions. Quote, I told them I didn't want their nickels and dimes for cleaning airplanes anymore. He says, I wanted to fly, end quote. At age 8, he got his first flight. Dwight was equally interested in art and earned a scholarship to pursue his passion after high school. His father would have none of it. art wasn't a real career, he insisted. Dwight should study engineering instead, so he enrolled at a junior college, receiving an associate's degree in 1953, the same year he enlisted in the Air Force. After finishing primary flight training, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant. Dwight also got a Bachelor's of Science in Aeronautical Engineering from Arizona State University. Discrimination was an ever-present reality in the armed forces at the time, but as a skilled pilot, he made captain. Kennedy wanted a black astronaut. That's when President John F. Kennedy, eager to link his administration's push for civil rights to the country's early space exploration efforts, asked for a black astronaut. At the time, it was test pilots who became astronauts, and there were no black test pilots. So Dwight was invited to attend the Air Force's newly opened Aerospace Research Pilot School, ARPS. But when he got the invitation letter, he almost threw it out, Dwight recalls. His Air Force peers, quote, got a big laugh out of it, telling him that all those guys have swagger and it's a club, end quote, he said, referring to the all-white astronaut corps. And they said, quote, they are not going to let you in that club. Quote, and of course they were right, he says. It was a huge career gamble. Dwight's father, who played baseball in the Negro Leagues, was strongly opposed. His mother, though, changed her son's mind. She said, quote, you're going to do this because she was thinking it would be uplifting the race and racial pride, he says, end quote. Upon entering the flight test program, Dwight experienced immediate pushback that he says was rooted in racism. He says Chuck Yeager, the famed test pilot who ran the school, resented having to accept a black candidate. Parentheses, Yeager, who died in 2020, wrote in his memoir that his only issue was Dwight's piloting skills, which he described as, quote, average. Once on the astronaut track, Dwight became a minor celebrity, especially in the black community. He appeared on the cover of magazines such as Ebony and Jet, but he also endured taunts of Kennedy's boy because of the president's support. Kennedy's 1963 assassination nearly derailed Dwight's training, he says. Days after the president's death, quote, he says, lo and behold, I had orders in my mailbox shipping me out of the country. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, the president's brother, intervened to keep him in the program, according to Dwight. He stayed in the Air Force for a few more years, but it became increasingly clear that he would not be selected as an astronaut. When I found out it wasn't going to happen, that's when I left the program, he says. I just packed my bags and left. After the Air Force, Dwight, who eventually settled in Denver, became a computer systems engineer for IBM, later opened a restaurant and worked as a real estate developer before being drawn back to his childhood love of art. Despite having little formal training, he was commissioned in 1974 to create a sculpture of Colorado's first black lieutenant governor, George Brown. From would-be astronaut to sculptor. From there, his reputation as a sculptor blossomed. In 1977, he earned a Master's of Fine Arts in Sculpture from the University of Denver. He specializes in sculpting historic African-American figures. Among his more notable pieces are busts of jazz greats, Dizzy Gillespie, and one of Louis Armstrong, on display at the National Museum of American History. Melvin, who is African-American, says when he met Dwight, he didn't know much about his backstory. He says, quote, I got a copy of his book and I read some of the stuff that he had done. He reminded me of Katherine Johnson, end quote, the NASA mathematician who led an all-women group of computers who made vital orbital calculations for the agency's early crewed space flights. Their story was featured in Hidden Figures, the book and film from 2016. Dwight and Melvin became close friends. In recent months, they have worked together on The Space Race, a documentary released last year about the contributions and experiences of black astronauts. Dwight's own story is prominent in that film. Melvin said of Dwight, quote, "He's not only funny, but self-deprecating. He's got grit." But the other thing that his mother taught him was grace. So when being an astronaut didn't work out all those years ago, he continues, quote, "He gracefully pivoted to doing something else. It was just as impactful, especially in the black community, which was his sculpture." Melvin says, quote, "He will now get his chance to do some zero-G floating and look at the planet from another vantage point," end quote. Next, we'll turn to the Denver Urban Spectrum, read extensively from that last week. This is from their May edition, and we're flipping into the middle of the news journal. "For a Mother's Day to recall, reclaim, and rejoice. CPRD announces spring concert, Legacy, opening the way." I don't yet see the author's name, but I'll announce it when I find it. "Heralding both Mother's Day and an exciting upcoming groundbreaking celebration, Cleo Parker Robinson Dance, CPRD, will host a spring concert featuring legacy works choreographed by David Receive, Winifred Harris, and the phenomenal Cleo Parker Robinson herself. Legacy, Opening the Way, reflects on the guides, guardians, ancestors, and community members whose support has been essential to the growth and progress of the Denver-based International Dance Company. Quote, 2024 is a momentous year for us," said CPRD founder and artistic director Parker Robinson. She went on, "The spring concert is only days ahead of groundbreaking for our facility expansion, literally doubling our ability to fulfill our mission." End quote. Legacy, Opening the Way, features interpretive excerpts that illustrate the ways in which we traditionally recall, reclaim, and rejoice. Parker Robinson exclaims, quote, "Our home here in the historic Shorter AME facility symbolizes our journey of strength, struggle, rebuilding, and resilience. Legacy, Opening the Way, celebrates the past, present, and future of growing our dreams from the ground up to new heights." End quote. A full weekend of events will begin Friday, May 10th at 7:30 p.m. with a VIP reception on Saturday, May 11th at 6:30 p.m. and a Mother's Day matinee performance on Sunday, May 12th at 2 p.m. The performance will begin with the celebratory processional choreographed by Parker Robinson and the CPRD artistic team, after honoring the ancestors and all who have supported the CPRD mission and vision, spiritual suite excerpts, "To My Father's House," "Mary, Don't You Weep," and "Roll Me Through the Rushes" will be featured, followed by "One Nation Under a Groove Part 2" and "When Wet Came to Paper." Poetry will be performed by CPRD co-founder Shailene Qualls, with musical inspirations featuring works by Nikki Giovanni and Nina Simone. Quote, "The work is a tribute to those who have passed on and those who are far away from me, us. In joy we celebrate. The work is based on a poem that I wrote when Curtis Frazier passed and I was missing my friends. Curtis was a part of the CPRD ensemble and one of my first dance partners. The work is a moving poem and is also a letter. As I've moved around the glove and created connections with people forever in our lives," end quote, says Harris, whose When Wet Came to Paper choreography will be featured at the end of the performance. Legacy, Opening the Way, will be held at the CPRD Theater, located in Denver's historic Five Points neighborhood at 119 Park Avenue West. Tickets for Friday and Sunday performances are available from $35 to $45 for youth, elders, and adults. VIP tickets include a reception with heavy appetizers, refreshments, and a first edition copy of The Swans of Harlem, featuring Carlia Shelton Benjamin, a retired ballerina and previous CPRD guest teaching artist, who will be in attendance during the VIP pre-performance meet and greet and during intermission. All are invited to attend this moving performance in celebration of Mother's Day and CPRD's ongoing journey as it prepares to move into its next chapter. Next, from the DUS still, reading another profile piece written by Wayne Trujillo, Chauncey Billups' journey to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. Basketball icon Chauncey Billups stands well over 6 feet tall. He also stands as a towering example of success, succeeding strife, inspiration, conquering frustration, and unwavering confidence, overcoming doubt, Billups' accolades, on and off the court, span decades. The latest feat may be the summit, a pinnacle of which every basketball player dreams, though few actually realize. ESPN posted on Associated Press article, posted an Associated Press article on April 6th, proclaiming, quote, two icons from the 2000s era of basketball are headed to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, end quote. Billups is one of the two icons, and a hometown hero in his own right. Success is sweeter when the road is rougher. An induction into the prestigious Hall of Fame is a heady honor for the Denver native, who had already assumed near-mythic status in the city's Park Hill neighborhood, even before he entered George Washington High School. Dubbed the King of Park Hill and Smooth, the youth dazzled friends, family, and neighbors. His reach extended beyond Park Hill when he collected accolades and titles throughout high school. Billups' entry on the Colorado Encyclopedia recounts a rush of honors bestowed early on. However, the early years weren't all starry-eyed and smooth. As his reputation suggested, Billups confronted early realities and was faced with decisions that ultimately determined his destiny. As the legend explains in a recent video interview titled Chauncey Billups, The Story You Haven't Heard Before, his path diverged from several of his early peers, some of whom he states were better players, simply due to pre-adolescent decisions. Billups talks about idle time without direction, leading talented youth astray and away from their goals. Some of his friends and teammates were exiled from school and sports, while others chose paths leading straight into juvenile detention facilities. Quote, so that was the only example that I needed at a young age. I said, okay, I've got to start making my own decisions here. Billups states in the candid interview, he goes on, I can't just go following people, or I need to find the right people to follow, end quote. He says the realization struck him at 11 or 12 years of age. The all-around sportsman also stopped playing football long after his epiphany for practical purposes. Billups states that he was a better basketball player and that any collegiate aspirations relied on securing a scholarship. So he dove deep, concentrating on excelling at the sport that could deliver his dream with singular focus. Daring decisions. In addition to making basketball his singular athletic outlet, Billups also made another fateful decision. He'd originally planned to enroll in an out-of-state college, but the loss of his grandparents during the final year of high school and his mother's ambivalence at his impending absence led him to unexpectedly decide to attend the University of Colorado, CU, in Boulder. It was a decision that carried him a distance from his previous plans, but kept him closer to home. CU Boulder's basketball team seemed a lackluster choice for the hotshot player at the time, but the ballplayer's consideration and prioritization of his family when making the professional decision triumphed, as it would in later decisions. Quote, I just felt it in my heart, man, and in my spirit. I said, it's not time for me to leave, he explains. He goes on, if I'm supposed to make it, I will make it, no matter where I go, end quote. According to Billups, two events conspired to abruptly end his successful college career and go professional. Piper, his then girlfriend and current wife, was pregnant with their first child, and his mother was laid off from her job of 20 years. Both household bills and the NBA beckoned. He said, quote, "I gotta go. It's time for me to step up and earn," end quote. A lifelong career. In 2008, the famed baller made his way back to his hometown, playing for the Denver Nuggets for several seasons before moving on to the New York Knicks and the Los Angeles Clippers. In 2013, he returned to the Detroit Pistons, where he retired from the professional sport the following year. Now, Mr. Big Shot is still on the court as head coach of the Portland Trail Blazers. He leverages his experiences, insights, and ability to connect with a new generation of basketball talent to score points decades after entering the big leagues as a player. In August, his legacy will be safely enshrined in the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, along with other accomplished basketball stars and memorabilia from the greatest moments in basketball history. Pardon me. He says, quote, "I've always just felt like I will win, sometimes not immediately, but definitely," end quote. And that article was edited for length. Next, still reading from the Denver Urban Spectrum, we have The Spirituals Project announces its 2024 symposium titled Prayer, Protest, and Praise. Looking for an author's name here. Don't see one yet. An exciting lineup of guests will speak on the topic of prayer and how it functions as one of the primary themes of Negro spirituals. After emancipation, there were many who wanted to divest themselves of any vestiges of slavery, which included the singing of spirituals. From the civil rights movement through the early 2000s, a large portion of the black church sought to attract young adults who had left the church by bringing in more contemporary or popular music. This further resulted in the fading out of hymns and spirituals. The goal of the 2024 symposium is to engage local black churches and re-interest them in the singing of spirituals through the vehicle of prayer. The day will conclude with an evening performance by the Spirituals Project Choir, presented by CPR Classical. The symposium and concert will take place on Saturday, May 18th, at the Robert and Judy Newman Center for the Performing Arts on the University of Denver campus. The symposium will begin at 11 a.m. with a keynote address titled Down Here, Lord, Waiting on You, an exploration of the theological and devotional legacy of the Negro spiritual by Dr. Tammy L. Kernodle, I think that's Kernodle, who is an internationally recognized musician and scholar. The program will continue with an address by Reverend Dr. Lee Butler, the newly appointed president of the Iliff School of Theology. A panel discussion will feature Dr. Kernodle, Dr. Butler, renowned choral conductor and composer Rollo Dilworth, who also will be featured as guest conductor for the evening concert, and local pastors. The panel discussion will center on why the spirituals are still relevant today and how pastors can integrate them into their services. Finally, Dr. Arthur Jones, founder of the Spirituals Project, we'll discuss the spirituals as a form of contemplative prayer, which is one of the themes of the new epilogue, pardon me, of a new epilogue in the recently released 30th anniversary edition of his book, Wade in the Water, The Wisdom of the Spirituals. Registration for the symposium is now available. Admission is free and open to the public. General admission for the 7:30 concert, that's 7:30 p.m., in the Newman Center's Gates Concert Hall is also free, with a limited number of $5 tickets available for reserved seating in the parterre section of the hall. Tickets are required for both general admission and parterre seats. Editor's note, to register, visit Sorry, this one's going to have lots of letters in it. Let me see if there's a phone number given. Nope. So we have to register for this event, https://bit.ly/3U6cp. Or you can go to their website for tickets, visit https://liberalarts.du.edu/node, these are backslashes, /372234. Or for more information about the Spirituals Project, visit https://liberalarts.du.edu/Lamont/spirituals-project. About the Spirituals Project. The Spirituals Project was founded in 1998 with a mission to preserve and revitalize the music and teachings of the sacred songs called spirituals, created and first sung by enslaved Africans in America in the 18th and 19th centuries. In 2016, the Spirituals Project became an official program of the University of Denver Lamont School of Music. And now, still reading from Denver Urban Spectrum. Letters, op-eds, and opinions. An evaluation of racial equity in Colorado. We must take action now to better understand our past and build a better future. An op-ed by Senator James Coleman, Representative Leslie Herod, and Representative Nikita Ricks. The state of Colorado has a rich and storied history in its nearly 150 years as a state. Coloradans are, rightly, very proud to call our majestic state home. Every day we feel honored to represent the innovative, diverse, inclusive, and forward-thinking people of our districts. However, not all Coloradans have had the same experiences throughout our state's history, particularly Black Coloradans. Though Colorado was not a slave state, slavery was only fully abolished in the Colorado State Constitution in 2018. There is also a tragically deep history of prejudice and discrimination in our state. From the prevalence and strength of the Ku Klux Klan at all levels of government, parentheses, a former mayor of Denver being a member as recently as 1947, to the, quote, sundown towns that dotted the state's terrain, where Black Coloradans were not welcomed and even faced violence, our state has much to reckon with. In fact, as recently as April 2024, a sitting lawmaker refused to vote for a resolution in honor of Black History Month. We believe it's time that we work to understand Colorado's history of racial inequity and prejudice and evaluate the ways in which it continues to reverberate into the present, specifically the impacts it has had on Black Coloradans today. That's why we are sponsoring Senate Bill 53, SB 24-053, to conduct a statewide racial equity study. This legislation will establish the Black Coloradan Racial Equity Study Commission and facilitate research to investigate if and how state politics have led to past and current discrimination against Black Coloradans. Our study in Colorado will specifically require the commission to explore the areas of K-12 education, higher education, workforce training, housing, criminal justice and policing, health care, tax policy, and economic mobility. It will include status updates and reports with recommendations based on the outcome of community engagement sessions and historical research. Once the study has been completed, the commission will publicize its findings and make policy recommendations to foster opportunities for healing and repair in our communities. Colorado's current reality reveals inequity in housing, education, healthcare, and the criminal justice system. This letter has to be edited for length as well. I'm skipping to the last paragraph now. As Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, "Now is the time to make justice a reality to all of God's children," end quote. As a legislature, we must take action now to shed light on our past so that we can build a brighter future. Editor's note, SB 24-053 has successfully made its way through the Colorado Senate. It will move through the House of through the House Appropriations Committee and the Legislative Council before heading to the Colorado House of Representatives floor for a final vote. And that's all of the time we have for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. This was the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.